The San Bernardino shooting is the 355th mass shooting this year in the U.S. It's at least the third mass shooting since the rampage last Friday in Colorado. Once again, the question, is it a turning point? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, I ask political analyst Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa to share her thoughts about this latest mass shooting and ask her whether it changes the standoff over gun legislation. We'll also listen to a short conversation I had yesterday with Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Then Gazette sports columnist Mike Loss on the Hawkeyes' perfect 12-0 season, and Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register on young Iowa women entering male-only sports like high school football. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's start with politics and that shooting in California. In just a moment, we'll have a conversation I had yesterday with Bernie Sanders before the news of that tragedy broke. But first, the political repercussions of the mass shooting yesterday in San Bernardino, California. I'm joined now by Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Let's listen to the president speaking earlier this morning about the shooting. He said, we do not know the motivations of the alleged shooters. It's possible that it's terrorist-related. It's possible that it's workplace-related, the president said. He said it's possible that there are mixed motives. And he went on to make another call for legislative action.
We can't just leave it to our professionals to deal with the problem of these kinds of horrible killings. We all have a part to play. And I do think that as the investigation moves forward, it's going to be important for all of us, including our legislatures, to see what we can do to make sure that when individuals decide that they want to do somebody harm, we're making it a little harder for them to do it. Because right now it's just too easy. We're going to have to, I think, search ourselves as a society to make sure that we can take basic steps that would make it harder, not impossible, but harder for individuals to get access to weapons.
President Obama speaking just a couple of hours ago from the White House. Donna Hoffman, does this change anything? We have this rash of mass shootings last week, the Planned Parenthood shooting just yesterday, this shooting. Does this change anything about the political discussion on guns?
Well, you know, Ben, I was on your show 3 years ago in December of 2012 in the aftermath of the Newtown, Connecticut shootings, where we had the same discussion. That was 3 years ago. Is it a tipping point is basically the question. And, you know, I think in repeated statements that we've had from the president recently, he has had a visible level of frustration with the fact that he has to go before the American public, before the news media, repeatedly and talk about these mass shootings. But yet it is something that, as you heard him say there, kind of a national soul-searching here. It's really in Congress's hands in terms of legislation as to whether they want to pursue mental health reforms. That's something that Republicans have talked about, whether they want to pursue, you know, assault weapons bans or increased background checks. Those are things for Congress to do. Congress responds, or at least theoretically, to the American public. And so the big question in terms of, you know, is this finally the tipping point, is probably, unfortunately, no, in that, you know, neither mental health reforms nor increased background checks or those kinds of things have moved. So is this something that moves the American public to try to move their members of Congress? My guess is no. But, you know, there's startling statistics coming out now in the wake of this shooting that are getting a lot of play in the media in terms of how many mass shootings just have we had this year. And I think it's, you know, 355, and that's more than one a day, or, you know, it averages out to a little bit more than that. And, you know, I think part of the frustration and some of the things you've heard of out of Obama have also related to this can't become the new normal. And I think that is a real danger in that the public gets a bit desensitized, and it's another day, it's another shooting. And the question really is, and it's a great question, and I don't have an answer to it, as to when there might be consideration of legislation, whether from a Republican perspective, again, looking at mental health issues, or from a Democratic perspective, which Democrats tend to be more in favor of strengthening regulations, whether any of those things happen.
Mm-hmm. Another thing the president pointed out, I think, yesterday, that we have no fly lists for people who may not board commercial aircraft, but these same people could go out and buy a gun. Too dangerous to board an aircraft, not too dangerous to acquire a gun. There is something new way of looking at it. But also behind that, Donna, I wonder, we don't know the motivations of these alleged shooters at this point. What difference does it make politically if this is labeled, in the end, domestic terrorism or workplace violence or mixed motivations?
Well, you know, I think it would affect it to some degree how people, you know, interpret what happened. So if it is found to be something that is an incidence of workplace violence, you know, we have incidents like that. Again, it's just a mass shooting. If it's a mass shooting, though, that involves a political aim, which is essentially, you know, how we think about defining terrorism, is it a use of violence for some kind of political end, then it does then kind of expand the discussion in terms of combating terrorism at home, making parallels to what happened recently in Paris. But again, as the president pointed out, we don't know. And whether it's an act of workplace violence or whether it's an act of domestic terrorism, it's a mass shooting. And it does subtly, I think, change the discussion around that. But it is still a mass shooting, whether these perpetrators had access to weapons and, you know, had explosives and body armor as well. So there was some level of planning conceivably there also. And what do you do about that result can be a similar discussion depending on whether it's workplace violence or domestic terrorism.
Mm-hmm. In the last few days, we've had the Paris attacks, as you mentioned, the attack last week at Planned Parenthood in Colorado. Overall, the mass shootings that we don't even hear about in national news because they have become everyday occurrences, as you mentioned there. I wonder, with all of this context, what are your thoughts about how the continued focus on these threats, on national security, possible domestic terrorism, how they might be shaping the presidential race now that we're about 2 months away from the Iowa caucuses?
Well, it certainly brings up points that these candidates have to respond to and have to respond to rather quickly. And so, you know, in some ways, that's part of what we have campaigns for. We want to see candidates put through the paces on the trail. Events happen in a campaign. They happen in the Oval Office. How do presidential candidates and, you know, future presidents respond to those events? That's something to for voters to always look at. And so does it change the discussion? I mean, I don't think that you're going to see it changes the emphases that you get. The candidates have positions on, you know, the things, the issues, the policy issues that are being brought up by these events, and those positions are very unlikely to change. It's just what are we focusing on, and what are they being asked about, and sometimes they're being asked about things in relation to what another candidate has said, for example, in this area. So it brings it to the fore in terms of the race for that day and the public attention for that day.
Donna Hoffman, yesterday, just to remind our listeners, Donna Hoffman is with us of the University of Northern Iowa, where she's Associate Professor of Political Science, one of our regular political analysts on Politics Wednesday, usually. This is a break from that. Donna, yesterday I spoke with Vermont Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. I wanted to have us listen to that conversation and get your reaction to it. We've been interviewing we've been inviting all the presidential candidates to come on this program to share their views. Let's listen to my conversation with Bernie Sanders yesterday And we should note that this conversation took place before the breaking news of the shootings in California.
Hey, Ben, how are you?
Hey, Senator Sanders, welcome to our program.
Thanks very much for having me.
I understand you had some minor surgery on Monday. I hope you're feeling better and recovering.
I am.
Very
I am.
Good.
Thank you.
Let's get right to some of the things in our news to get your views. The Paris attacks have put national security on everyone's minds. How would security, national security, under a Bernie Sanders administration be different than what we currently have or under a Clinton administration?
Well, all I can tell you is that when you have a barbaric organization like ISIS, it has got to be eliminated. It has got to be destroyed. On the other hand, what I do not want is to see the United States and our troops and our taxpayers get involved in perpetual warfare in the Middle East. And I think what has got to happen is that a major coalition has got to be put together consisting of the Arab nations in the region, supported by the United States, by the United Kingdom and France. But the boots on the ground have got to be done by the Muslim nations. I was very impressed by King Abdullah of Jordan, who recently made that point. He said, look, terrorism is an international problem, but it is mostly our problem. We are fighting for the soul of Islam. We have got to lead the effort. And he's right. And we have got to be supportive of Jordan, and we've got to be supportive of all of those countries in the region who are prepared to take on ISIS. And I will tell you, Ben, that one of the concerns that I have is you have extraordinarily wealthy countries in that region, countries like Qatar, countries like Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, who are unbelievably wealthy but are really not contributing the kind of support that they should be to the war against ISIS. So this is something that we have to deal with.
Let's talk briefly about the renewable fuel standard. Monday, the required renewable fuels standard level for 2016 was announced, and renewable fuel and corn producers, along with some Iowa officials, are criticizing the Obama administration's new requirement for the amount of ethanol. This is the amount of ethanol that must be blended into the nation's gasoline. They say it falls far short of the aggressive production targets that Congress set nearly a decade ago. What's your reaction to this new level for 2016?
Well, I share that concern of Iowa corn growers, and I'll tell you why. I happen to believe that climate change is the great global environmental crisis that we face. And what the scientists tell us, if we do not get our act together in the very near future, a bad situation will become much worse. And what that means is we have got to do everything that we can to break our dependence on fossil fuel, move to energy efficiency, and move to sustainable energies. I know Iowa is doing a really great job in terms of wind and in terms of biofuels. So I think we have to be supportive of that effort and take every step that we can in every way that we can, including the growth of the biofuels industry, to break our dependency on fossil fuels.
Staying with climate change, the president has said in Paris he's hopeful that a global deal on climate change could be reached at this summit. Do you share his optimism?
Well, I certainly hope that he is right. You know, Pope Francis recently said that the world is on a suicidal path with regard to climate. And I think he is right. I think this is a very, very serious problem. I think that if we are concerned about the kind of planet that our children and our grandchildren are going to inherit, it is absolutely imperative that we transform our energy system and we work with countries all over the world, which is presumably what's going on in Paris right now, to move away from coal and oil and gas into energy efficiency and wind and solar and biofuels and other sustainable energies. What we are seeing right now, Ben, is the hottest year on record. We're seeing more floods. We're seeing more drought. We're seeing rising sea levels. We are seeing the acidification of the ocean. We've got some very, very serious problems regarding climate change, and I would hope that the United States leads the world in transforming our energy system. It's absolutely imperative that we do that.
Iowa has the highest incarceration rate per capita for black people in the country, Senator Sanders. Perhaps you're aware of that, in part because of arrests for marijuana possession. That racial disparity in arrests for marijuana possession is a trend nationwide. What would you do about that as president?
Well, you make a good point in terms of disparities. It turns out that based on the studies that I have seen, whites and blacks utilize marijuana at about the same percentage. And yet blacks are four times more likely to get arrested than whites. Right now you have a law in the federal government which is called the Controlled Substance Act. And the Controlled Substance Act has on Schedule 1 marijuana right alongside of heroin. I think that makes no sense at all. What we have seen for the last number of decades is literally millions of people getting police records for possession of marijuana. When you got a police record, it makes it harder for you to get a job. It makes it harder for you to get credit. It has a real impact on your life. So what I have proposed and introduced legislation to do is to take marijuana out of the Controlled Substance Act. It will no longer be a federal crime. If states want to legalize marijuana, that's their business. That is a state's business. But it should not be a federal crime.
Senator Sanders, I've spoken with a number of your supporters here in Iowa. They are passionate indeed for your ideas. But when I ask if they have any concerns about your candidacy, a number have mentioned your age. You're 74 now, and one said, I wish he were younger. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm feeling great. You know, I have been blessed with good health. We're running a very energetic campaign. And Ben, I think the issues that we are talking about, which is an economy today which is rigged, where almost all new income and wealth is going to the top 1%, and a campaign finance system which is corrupt, which allows billionaires to buy elections, I think those are the dominant themes that resonate with people in Iowa and all over this country, to be honest with you. So I'm feeling great. Yeah, we all wish we were younger. I wouldn't mind being 30 again. But the fact is we are where we are. And being 74 and having been in Congress and having been a mayor gives me a whole lot of experience as well, which I think is useful as we pursue this presidency right now.
Senator Sanders, we're asking all the candidates we interview to describe Iowa in their words, in three words. Three words that you would use to describe Iowa would be?
Beautiful, down to earth.
Beautiful, down to earth. I guess that qualifies. Sounds good. Thank you very much, Senator Sanders.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. Take care.
It's a conversation I had yesterday with Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. By the way, again, that was a conversation that took place before the news broke of the mass shootings in California. Donna Hoffman still with me, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Donna. In listening to that conversation, anything in particular you found interesting with Bernie Sanders?
Well, I would just point out, you know, what we were previously talking about, questions that you asked of Senator Sanders would probably be very different, you know, if you had the knowledge of the shooting that had gone on. But, you know, here's Sanders wanting to do well in Iowa, obviously, wanting to appeal to Iowans, and at the same time wants to draw a contrast between himself and Hillary Clinton as well, wants to appeal to Iowans. So we get some discussion about the renewable fuel standard, for example, something that was has certainly been on people's minds, the Paris attacks and what we do in that regard. And so, you know, here's Sanders doing what you do in a campaign, trying to appeal. And in particular, I noticed his discussion of both the Paris summit on climate change, as well as talking about the renewable fuel standard, is, you know, talking very broadly about that particular issue, not really getting too much in terms of specifics, other than moving away from fossil fuels, kind of an all-of-the-above strategy in terms of expanding that out.
Mm-hmm. I also asked Bernie Sanders, about his age. I've been hearing that as a concern from Bernie Sanders supporters that I've talked to. And it's interesting there that he had rather a charming comeback for that. And I think I was reminded, and I'm sure you would remember this too, Donna Hoffman. Let's listen to President Reagan. If Bernie Sanders did become president, he would be inaugurated, I believe, at the age of 75. That would surpass Ronald Reagan, the oldest to assume office, who was just shy of 70 years old when he was first inaugurated. And here's a bit of audio that will take us back a few years, Donna. This is Ronald Reagan debating Walter Mondale, and he was asked about his age, and here was his famous comeback.
You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience.
Ronald Reagan there leaving office, that was the obviously a debate before his second re-election. He left office nearly 78 years old. Haven't heard much about age in this campaign, have we, Donna?
We actually haven't. And, you know, I think some of that is that, you know, if you look at former President Carter, he's still alive. President George H.W. Bush, also still alive. They've been out of office for quite some time. Ford and Reagan lived to be to healthy ages, very old ages, actually. Those four presidents, I believe, are the oldest presidents to have lived. And so part of that is a commentary or evidence, potentially, of the fact that, you know, lifespans in the United States have increased. We have better health care. We have better nutrition than we used to have. But age hasn't been brought up enough, and I was actually kind of surprised that you've been hearing that from some of Bernie Sanders' supporters, because, it is something that for some people will be an issue, because stamina in the presidency is important. But again, if Bernie Sanders is able to, at the age of 74, able to go around the country and talk to big rallies and shake hands and do the things that he is doing, what all these presidential candidates have to do in a modern campaign, and he's reportedly in good health, even though he just had a minor surgery. It was nothing serious, we know. And so that's part of the reason why we have presidential campaigns. And while we didn't design them to be grueling, they actually are grueling. And that does serve a purpose in that, are you up to the rigors of the office? Can you do these things? Can you, you know, not just talk to voters and answer their questions, but can you do the things that you need to do around the country, which is very rigorous, because that's, you know, potentially something that shows voters that you're up for the task of being president.
Okay, Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Coming up in the second half of our program, I'll be speaking with Mike Halas, a sports columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Of course, we'll be talking about 12-0, the Hawkeyes' winning streak this season, the first time that they have had a undefeated season since way back in 1922. And Mike Loss will tell us about that 1922 team, and look forward to the Hawkeyes game this weekend, as well as the change in the head coach situation for Iowa State University's football team. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour we dedicate to Iowa sports in the news. Well, if an alien beamed down to Iowa right after Friday's Hawkeye win over Nebraska, that alien might have thought the expression 12-0 was the most common greeting among Earthlings in these parts. The last time the University of Iowa football team went undefeated in a regular season was way back in 1922. Joining us with his perspective on the Hawkeyes' perfect regular season, their next big game this weekend, the college football playoff quarterfinal against Michigan State in Indianapolis. And we want to also talk about Iowa State's new football coach. Mike Halas joins us again, columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you, Ben?
I'm fine. Well, they won, some say. I think you did, too. It was an ugly win. What's your comment on the game?
Well, I don't know if it was ugly, but it was just the weather conditions weren't good, and so I think that Iowa kind of had to tuck away some of its offensive playbook and just basically be conservative and cautious and plus play sound defense. They did all those things. They prevailed in what was a very tense game and I think a nervous week. Turned out to be an explosion of joy by late Friday afternoon.
Right, but if you look at many of the stats for the game, total offense, third down conversions, I don't know, did Iowa even get one third down conversion?
No, none. I believe I read it's only the second time in the last 3 years a major college team has won without converting a third down. That statistic can be misleading and overrated sometimes, but Iowa got a lot of its points from good field position, and from the one statistic that really mattered most in this game, which was turnovers.
Mm-hmm.
Nebraska threw four interceptions. Some of them were very ill-conceived passes, and it sort of represented the difference between the two teams this year. Nebraska had a very loose offensive game. They were able to move the ball pretty well, but not it wasn't useful moving the ball. It was when they would get something going, Tommy Armstrong would throw a very ill-advised pass. Whereas Iowa didn't really take very many shots in this game, certainly not as many as usual, but it understood that it was a game of field position and a game of seizing opportunities when they cropped up, and inevitably they did crop up for Iowa. And that was... there was your statistic right there. Nebraska, four turnovers. That does not win games.
Mm-hmm. Something else that got people's attention, a Nebraska safety ejected from the game for a head-to-head hit with the Iowa wide receiver, Tavon Smith. Comment about that. Is this mark a change in the way the NCAA is trying to protect players from potentially very dangerous hits?
It does. This rule has been instituted, has been in effect for a few years now. The hit that Gary made, I think the consensus from people who saw it wasn't intentional, it wasn't malicious, but it was head-to-head. And they're not officiating this on intent. It's did it happen or did it not happen? But it's still that elephant in the corner, concussions and head injuries in football. And in that same game, Iowa linebacker Ben Neiman was inadvertently hit in the helmet by a teammate during a tackle. And watching him as he was pulled to his feet, it was kind of a sickening thing because he was clearly, he was beyond woozy. He looked like he was out while standing up with his eyes open, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
It was like you'd seen a boxer who had been getting tagged over and over and over again and didn't know where his corner was.
Right.
From time to time you see that in football, and it's like concussions are still something that they've got to get a handle on head injuries in this sport or the game's going to deteriorate.
You wrote about this last game, also notable in it, Desmond King, a real standout this season for the Hawkeyes. You wrote, how does a football team get to be 12-0? By suspending its best defensive player for the first quarter of the 12th game because he arrived late for a team meeting during the week? No, of course not. But actually, yes. he was suspended that first one. How unusual is that sort of action in this context?
I don't know. Because I don't know the hearts and minds of every major college football coach, but my guess, my hunch, maybe my gut feeling is that a lot of coaches would have given a different punishment that didn't affect the game. You're not going to lift your best defensive player, the player who this week was voted the Big Ten's best defensive back, a lot of coaches would not yank him out of any portion of a game with that much significance. These chances are so rare, especially for a program like Iowa's, and you want all hands on deck, particularly your best hands. But at the same time, I think a veteran coach, a smart coach, says, if I make an exception here, I've got everybody in this program looking at me and saying, the rules don't apply the same for everybody, and the principles can be changed depending on the situation.
Mm-hmm. Mike Loss with us of the Gazette. Iowa hasn't had an undefeated team in the regular season since 1922. You looked back at this 1922 team. What can you tell us about it?
Well, they only played seven games, for one thing. It's interesting to go back and look at how the games evolved. I mean, Iowa played a game at Yale back then, and it was considered one of the best matchups of the entire college football season. Yale and Princeton used to be national powers, which is kind of funny to people now, because they're not even playing what is called major college football. They're at the same level, technically, as Northern Iowa. But really, they aren't, because they're playing non-scholarship football out there. But back then, they were kingpins, and Iowa took a train ride in the middle of the season to Connecticut to play a big football game against Yale that was, you know, covered by the Chicago Tribune, among other outlets. And, you know, there goes your week.
Right.
You know? So they came back home, and I suppose they got home on a Tuesday or something, and then they have a game against Illinois that following Saturday. The Illinois coach, who's a Hall of Fame coach, I believe they've named the field after him in Champaign, named Zupke, his team played that week against Butler University of Indianapolis. And instead of accompanying his team to that game, he went to Connecticut himself to scout Iowa. It was such an important thing for him that his team was about to play the Hawkeyes. And as it turned out, his own Illinois team lost to Butler that week, so that was kind of a failed move on his part. But just, I mean, such a difference 93 years later. Iowa played 12 players in that game. I mean, you have to play 11. 10 of the 11 players never left the field.
That's amazing. When you consider the average college team of Iowa's caliber has how many total players today?
Well, I mean, you have 83 scholarship players plus a slew of walk-ons.
All right. That gives us some idea. Let's look forward to your take on the game this weekend, the college football playoff quarterfinal against Michigan State. What will the Hawkeyes have to do to win a very impressive Michigan State team?
Ball protection is what people will say before any game, and I think it's true in this game. But I think poise is going to be big. Michigan State, as Kirk Ferentz has said, will make big plays. The trick is not to let one big play turn into three or four. Bing, 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 bing. I think that the game being played indoors, you know, I think that's going to help Iowa. The last 2 weeks, the weather conditions Iowa's played in were pretty bad. Raw, windy, cold. I think that it's affected how they've played the game on offense, and I think they're a more interesting, diverse offensive team than we've seen the last couple of weeks. So I think we'll see more of that, and I think they'll have to be, because they're not going to be able to beat Michigan State by just playing smash-mouth football. I mean, you could, but you're going to have a lot of different things in your arsenal, I think, Saturday night.
The Hawkeyes on the cover of Sports Illustrated with the title Iowa Raucous, New Kirk, New QB, New Title Contenders. What is your reading on what the Hawkeyes are doing differently this season? What is the new Kirk vision here that seems to be working wonderfully?
Well, it is. When you said New QB, that hit the nail on the head. C.J. Beathard, the quarterback, has been a difference maker. When you have a really good quarterback in football, you've got a chance. It's just, it's that way. It's always been that way. It'll always be that way. You see it in the NFL. The, you know, the New England Patriots with Tom Brady, it seems like Tom can be playing with, you know, any 10 guys that they bring off the street, they have a chance. Well, Beathard has been, I mean, without Beathard this season, I think they've got 2, 3, maybe even 4 losses. He just keeps plays going, poised in the fourth quarter, and really good mechanics. Just has an innate understanding of what to do in game situations. And also just the player, the entire roster. You know, the it's such a fragile ecosystem, a sports roster, and it seems like this year, for whatever reason, they've just got the right blend of people and personalities and skills. And sometimes it's just that simple.
Let's pivot quickly before we have to say goodbye from Iowa City in the eastern part of the state to Ames, Iowa State University football. Hiring a new coach less than 2 weeks after firing Paul Rhodes, you wrote that the hire was surprisingly quick, and it was. Some would think, well, university hires have to have public searches and a whole bunch of things attached to them. How did they do that so quickly?
Well, how do they do that so quickly? There are different rules. I don't think they are. I don't know if they're rules or not. But the reality is, it's an enormously competitive thing when major colleges have openings for coaching jobs in football and men's basketball, the two revenue sports. And it's as if rules almost don't exist, because the urgency with which schools like to hire coaches to fill these jobs is high. And one critical reason is recruiting. The sooner you get a coach hired, the sooner he can fill out his own staff, the sooner that those people can hit the road and then replenish the lifeblood of those programs, which is players, talent, you know, the commodities. So there's a lot of looking the other way when it comes to sports. I mean, nepotism rules seem to be different, too. It's one of those deals where the public seems to be good with it, and you never have anybody saying, wait a minute, I applied for this job, and they didn't give, you know, 15 days or whatever the laws are. It's just one of those things where, you know, wink, wink. It's like forever in the day, the National Football League was ruled a nonprofit by the U.S. government, which was just absurd. And who had a real problem with it? I mean, not the public, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the world we live in.
Very quickly before we go, goodbye to Paul Rhodes, head coach at Iowa State, 2009 to 2015. Tell us about the new coach, Matt Campbell.
Young, very young for a head coach, 36. You seldom see coaches that young in major college football. Has been head coach at Toledo for 4 years. Had winning records in all of those years. The concern is he's never built his own program. I think that's a bit overblown. He's been a winner at wherever he's been. All he's known is winning. And I think that had a lot to do with the athletic director at Iowa State, Jamie Pollard, hiring him. You never know about these things. Coaches and jobs, sometimes it's round holes and square pegs or vice versa. But the consensus from people who follow this stuff around the country was that this was a coach who was going to go somewhere else from Toledo this winter, and he's a highly regarded guy, and that Iowa State did pretty well. So we'll see.
Okay. Mike Loss, thank you very much for your perspective. Sports columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Until next time, Mike.
Thank you.
You're listening to River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And to finish up this hour, in addition to the history that the Hawkeyes are making on the college gridiron, we saw something interesting about the high school football state championship that was held just a few weeks ago. Pella High School won the 3A state championship. And here's what's different. Not all the players on that team were guys. Vanessa Chapman,
a 110-pound senior, stands 5 feet 6 inches tall, was also on that team. She became only the second female in state history to be part of a championship high school football team. Kyle Munson is with us, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register, and for a recent column, he looked into the history behind girls playing football in Iowa. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Ben. Good to talk to you.
We want to throw in this note that Vanessa did not play in that state championship game, but she was on the team. How unique is Vanessa?
Well, that's what I wonder. I mean, this is just one of those little wormholes of curiosity that I kind of meandered down because, you know, somebody had sent me a note and mentioned that she was on the team, and I started talking to colleagues and other people. I wondered, you know, is she the first? How unique is she? And based on the best research, she is probably the second girl to play on a state championship team, football team. There was another woman, Angie Lance, back in 1988, was probably the first. And she now, I mean, she's a coach at a Catholic high school in Council Bluffs now for a volleyball team. So she's remained in sports. But, you know, there's at the Iowa High School Athletic Association in Boone, Bud Legg is kind of he's their go-to historian, you know, and he works with the media and everything. And he's just a walking, you know, font of knowledge. And so, you know, he dug back into his archives. And so he thinks that Vanessa is the second and nobody else has stepped forward since I wrote my column or, you know, it's been discussed.
So you talked with the first in the history books for this, Angie Lance, back in the 1980s. So what did you find out from her?
Well, I wanted to know from her what it was like, had it been a huge topic of conversation at that time. And, you know, I asked her, why did you play? And she said, well, why not? And I said, well, okay, that's a fair enough answer. And, you know, there was some discussion. And I even went back into our microfilm archives. And, you know, there was a photo of one of her siblings cheering from the sidelines, you know, from the bleachers and cheering her on. So, you know, and she obviously just has remained involved in sports and as a coach now, too. So it really was a central part of her life.
Mm-hmm. And she comes from a football family, I saw in your article.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So she, you know, it was, I mean, Vanessa even has, if you're talking about Vanessa from Pella, I mean, she has a brother who's a sophomore, and he would have played all of this year on the team, except he's healing from a broken leg. And, So he'll continue to play next year. And so, you know, it was just heartening to me to kind of see, to talk to these girls and to understand why they were playing. And I remember even back when I was in high school in the 1980s, there was a girl who was on a wrestling team for a time. So, I mean, these things do happen and they have happened. But to have, you know, football is such a central place in our culture. I mean, whether it's Super Bowl or you see what's happening with the Iowa Hawkeyes this fall, I mean, everybody always talks about the salaries for coaches. I mean, it is, and we obsess over a coaching change like they've had in Ames at the Iowa State University. I mean, you see how this takes up so much of the oxygen.
Right.
So to have girls like Vanessa and Angie stepping into this world, it's just it's a refreshing sign for me.
And I get the sense that when you have girls, young women who want to do this, really it's the thing holding them back sometimes is the perception, the fact that they're not expected to go there. And that is the biggest hurdle, so to speak, to get over. Friends and family, they're worried about what they'll think.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, Vanessa's mom even talked about, you know, because she started playing back in, you know, flag football back in fifth grade. And so her mom talked about kind of spying on her first practices then, and then also especially when, you know, she was getting older and then playing with, you know, the boys. And, parents worry when any kid plays a sport like that. You can always have an injury. But to have as boys and girls develop at first, somebody like Vanessa, you know, through middle school is more developed usually than boys. But then, of course, the boys tend to outstrip just in physical growth and everything. So it becomes much different. You know, not as level of playing field for most girls to step in and play against a whole group of guys. But, you know, yeah, culturally, there's so much deeply embedded in this conversation. I mean, look at the recurring topic of the pink visitors' locker room at
right.
the University of Iowa. You know,
yeah, right.
The whole
right.
notion of gender and what it means to be manly or sissy or whatever it is. It's just there's a lot to chew on in this conversation.
Right, and you mentioned wrestling brings to mind the 2011 Cassie Herkelman became the first girl to wrestle at a state tournament in Iowa. And wrestling's another male-dominated or almost exclusively male sport here. But do you get the sense that when we hear about cases like this that the gender roles are loosening concerning all male sports in Iowa?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to do a deep academic analysis and put some real numbers to it. But, yeah, I get the sense. Things are happening. I mean, there's a lot more conversation even around transgender in the last year. I mean, I saw Caitlyn Jenner at Drake University on the weekend of the recent Democratic debate, and so she's brought a lot of talk about this into the forefront. You know, in terms of an athlete, and now her role now. So I think there's a lot of movement, a lot of conversation, and from when Angie was playing to when Vanessa's been playing, I think there has been a lot.
Okay, Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Look for his article on this topic recently titled, What It Means to Play Football Like a Girl in Iowa. Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks, Ben.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.